The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Apple beats and hits an all-time high. U.S. dollar continues to trend lower. The biggest week of earnings now closed. And our guest is Mike Brown, research analyst at LendEDU. All this and much more on episode number 520 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening, of course, to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week to talk about all things related to finance, money, investing, and making sure that you have a successful future. Well, last week we covered an awful lot of things and got some interesting feedback. If you haven't listened to that show, make sure to go on to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 519. We talked about, in particular, at the end of the podcast, after we had our guest on, I talked about this area of negativity and all the people that are permanently negative out there and the negative news cycle and all the things that go into getting bad information, giving you bad vibes and making you do really unnecessary things in your trading to spook you out, to get you concerned. I really recommend that you, if you haven't done so already, that you listen to that, because again, we got a lot of great feedback on that. And of course, you can always give me feedback, whether it's on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, my handle there, or on the disciplinedinvestor.com website. You can go there and there's an area called Ask Andrew, and just click on that and submit your either comment, your question. We'll get to it on the show. One of these days coming up, we'll block them together. And if it's maybe on more of a personal level, we'll email you directly. And I'll make sure to get back to everybody that asks a question or has a comment. That's something that I do all the time. The other thing I want to mention is we had a pretty lively show this week on DH Unplugged. Each and every Tuesday night at 9 o'clock, we're live and streaming. And of course, you can also find it on the iTunes directory, and you can find it all sorts of areas that you get your usual podcast or your dose of podcast from. You can look for DH Unplugged. And we talk about some crazy things on there. If you haven't listened to that show yet, I really encourage you to do so. So what's going on this week? What's happening? Well, one of the things that we saw and we continue to see is the U.S. dollar having some trouble. And whether that's because of the political environment or it's because in Europe they're talking about pulling back on some of the accommodative central bank spending and quantitative easing that's going on. And we have seen a pretty significant move in the dollar, down about 10% this year. We've talked about this from time to time. But one of the things that we're seeing as a benefit and a byproduct of this is that the U.S. stocks, particularly those that are multinationals, have gotten a great tailwind from this condition. And we see that all the time in other areas. We're not as used to it here in the U.S. It just seems as investors, we overlook that a lot of times. But, you know, take Japan, for example. In Japan, their market is almost fully correlated to the level of the yen. When you see the yen coming down, because they're a major exporting country, when you see the yen come down, their markets do marvelous. When the yen gets stronger and it costs more money for their products from outsiders outside of Japan, their markets have a lot of trouble. Well, we've been seeing that in the U.S. there has been a tremendous amount of earnings growth, and some of it is clearly attributable to the U.S. dollar decline. A 10% decline in the dollar, think about that for a second, gives those companies and or people outside of the U.S. the opportunity to buy our products at a 10% discount compared to where it was, let's say, 6 months ago. That changes the whole environment and decision-making process of companies and individuals of what they're buying. And our products become cheaper, therefore, it helps them out in their production cycle, in their manufacturing cycle. So while it may not be the most beneficial situation when we look at traveling and people traveling here from an area of visitors and vacationers necessarily when we leave this country, I mean, it helps the people coming in, but it doesn't help us going outside because the other currencies get more expensive. Our dollar is worth less. But it does help our exports. And of course, one of the biggest beneficiaries have been the Dow Jones Industrial Companies, because many of them are multinationals that have a great deal of overseas exposure, some greater than 50 or 60%, and that is a significant amount of benefit to their bottom line. And you know that's the case because you haven't heard any of the companies come out talking about a constant currency adjusted earnings. And therefore, you know that they're not going to tell you that the currency helped them so much because they want to make it look like they were just in charge and they were the ones that made it happen. And their company did so great because of things that they did rather than the fact of blaming the weather or the currency or the political situation. They, you know, just absorb it as, oh, look how great we did. So the dollar's been a great benefit right now. And I think we're going to continue seeing that. In that until we get any kind of resolution on healthcare and taxes and there's just nothing right now from a political standpoint that looks like we are at all, we have our act together. I mean, we really don't. The turmoil in the White House, the lack of ability of the Congress. I'm not blaming the Republicans. I'm not blaming the Democrats or the liberals. It's just a fact. We know it. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. It's not the most effective and efficient government right now. And hopefully that will change soon. Maybe there's a big change. Maybe there's a big rotation going on from getting all the people that have been involved in businesses before, rather than being involved in government, involved in many of the key positions of the government. And maybe there's a transition time until they get their, you know, act together and understand how government is different than business. And you can't just strong arm your way in there. And maybe what's going to happen is that over time, this will change. Once we see that we continue to have a stronger dollar, which will also probably be offset by a dovish Fed, which we've seen them, even though they're raising rates, of course, talk dovishly in the background. So on one hand, they come out and Janet Yellen's talking about, you know, raising rates. But on the other hand, they're talking about how slowly they're going to do it. Well, that keeps the dollar suppressed as well. So there's a lot of action going on in the markets from a marketplace. I'm not talking about an individual stock base, but from a marketplace that is due to our current currency. So keep an eye on that. If you have a trading platform or charts or a watch list, keep the dollar on your screen and watch for any kind of turn right now. But we are hitting lows recently on the dollar, and that, again, has been helping dramatically. Let's see what else. I talked about DH Unplugged. I talked about that. Okay. Apple came out with some numbers this week, and there was, looks like they blew out mostly on, clearly on their earnings, but also they did a really good job on their iPads, which is a bit of a head scratcher. The iPhone slowed down a bit, but there's some question as to inventory use. So that was good. And the stock hit an all-time high. Again, once again, helping the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but helping the whole technology averages and helping the entire market because the monstrous weight of Apple in the indices. So that was a big help as well. So generally speaking, when we look back at what we've seen so far on earnings season, I think that it's okay. Now, economics, it's another story. We saw the recent levels of manufacturing slow down a little bit that we saw last week. We've seen some of the rolling down of consumer confidence. We've seen some of the individual sector or regional PMIs or manufacturing indices slow down a bit. So there's a question as to if there's an effect by the rising interest rates. But so far, so good. GDP at 2.6%. It's okay. So we're going to be happy about that for now. But let's get to our guest, because I want to talk about some of these areas of, I have a lot of questions for this guy. Let's get right to it. And with us today is Mike Brown. He's a research analyst at LendEDU, and he's written about everything from personal finance and student loans to the most recent millennial trends. He's been featured in The Washington Post, Business Insider, Market Watch, U.S. News World Report. You get around, buddy, huh?
Yeah, a little bit. I try, you know. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going really well. Thanks. Got lots to talk to you about. First of all, you know, this LendEDU, I was perusing the site, and there's all sorts of really interesting things on there to find out information and education. I guess, tell me about the name, LendEDU. It's LendEDU.com, right?
Correct.
So tell me about it. How did you get there?
So our main business right now is student loans and student loan refinancing. So I guess that's where the word lend came from.
Right.
We're trying to help people out with their loans. And then the EDU part, just trying to educate people on student loans, but also anything personal finance related.
Right.
So I guess that's where the name came about.
And you focus on obviously with student loans. I mean, hopefully we're not, you know, you don't have clients in their 50s that are still trying to pay off their student loans, right? So it's a much younger.
It's usually much younger people. We do deal with parents a lot that are working with their kids, whether they're a co-signer or, you know, their kid just doesn't know what to do. So the parent has to take the matters into their own hands. But yeah, we are generally dealing with the younger demographic.
Right. So I know there's a bunch of tools on there, but there's a bunch of articles that you had recently written about and topics that you wrote about that I wanted to talk about. And one of the trends that we've been seeing and we all know about is, and it's millennials, yes, but because they're the first to maybe embrace technology, because there was never a time in their lives that there wasn't technology, right?
Right, that's correct.
So they're much better at really embracing that. Old fogies like me, I like to do it, but it takes me an extra step to kind of know, like I was not the first on Venmo, right? You know, it took me a few weeks. Although I just looked, my 10-year anniversary on Twitter was just happened, it seemed. And I was on Twitter 7 days after they launched.
Wow. There you go.
So that's good.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I just got like my 9-year anniversary for Facebook. I thought I was on there longer, but not even a full decade yet.
Yeah. I think I must've gone on Facebook pretty much in the beginning. I prefer Twitter, but let's talk a little bit about some of these peer-to-peer payment platforms that are cropping up. And there's a bunch of them that happen all the time on a regular basis. The one, you know, I guess maybe one of the first that was not millennialized, which was meaning mobilized, was probably PayPal. That was one of the first ones that I remember out there. And that was interesting. You could pay a bunch of people on things and it was, you know, linked to your bank account. There was some pushback in the beginning. It was originally, if you know the beginning, but it was originally an eBay company. And eBay just had to find a way to create a payment processing for their various selling and all that and auctions. Then they spun it off into PayPal. It's its new standalone company. But tell me what's going on in the trends in terms of peer-to-peer payment with millennials and others.
So, I mean, well, I guess PayPal's golden child is Venmo. We did a survey a couple months ago that we found that almost 70% of millennials are using Venmo.
Mm-hmm.
It blew the competition out of the water. I know some banks have their own peer-to-peer mobile transaction apps, but you know, pretty much everyone uses Venmo. So they're kind of the leader in the industry. They really dominate the marketplace. But right now, a new app called Zelle was just launched in June.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of interesting. We actually just ran a report on it. And as it turns out, most Venmo users really don't know anything about Zelle. I think it was something like 95% have never even heard of Zelle, and another 88% don't even know what it is. Like 3% thought it was a ride sharing service like Uber or Lyft. So really no one knows what it is, but I mean, that's not really to their fault. They've only been launched for about a month, but it is an interesting competitor in terms of, you know, challenging Venmo. It was all the huge bank institutions came together, put aside their differences, so to say, and helped launch this app. All right, so the way Zelle works is that a little bit different than Venmo, because all the major banks came together to create it. And if I have a PNC account and you have a Chase account, I can transfer money from my account to your account, and it will be able to be in your account that same day, pretty much instantaneously. That's one of their main selling points, why you use Zelle over Venmo, because Venmo, it takes about a day, maybe a little bit longer, for the money to show up in your account once you withdraw. So they're really pitching themselves on that. We actually ran a survey, though, that showed that millennials really don't care that much about their money being instantaneously put into their bank account. It's actually kind of interesting. I use Venmo, and usually I don't even withdraw from Venmo. I kind of just let the money hang out.
Yeah, that's what I do too. Like, that's exactly how I do it. It's like, yeah. I got a Venmo account.
So kind of like its own currency.
Yeah, I want to leave it in the Venmo account, and I kind of let it hang out there, and I don't really do anything with the money unless I Venmo it to somebody else.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty unique part about Venmo. I think that's what a lot of people like Venmo is that it almost doesn't feel like real money because it's just kind of sitting in there and it's just changing hands. But the other thing that Zelle is pitching themselves on is just security. It was launched by the major banks, JP Morgan, Citi, Bank of America, and they're really pitching themselves as, your personal information will be much more secure on Zelle than it is on Venmo, an independent third-party app. We found that it was about 75 or 78% of the people that we polled felt secure on Venmo. So I don't really think that's an issue with Venmo either. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what Zelle does.
The one thing I don't like, I'll tell you one thing I don't like about Venmo, how it was originally positioned. It was positioned as a social sharing for money in that when you pay somebody and somebody approves you on their list, you can kind of scroll through and see all the different payments they may be made, unless they block any kind of public payments. But a lot of people don't know how to do that, maybe. Because I scrolled through, I'm like, oh, this guy paid that for what? And this guy paid that for what?
Yeah. That's a very good point.
That's the one thing I didn't like about Venmo. The other thing is, it's interesting because I don't know if you come across this, but one of the things that I'm finding is, with Venmo and from some of the younger people I know, there's a lot of, let's say that because it is outside the banking system, right? It's not, it's its own standalone, as you said, its own currency. A lot of people are lulled into the sense that, well, I'll pay my drug dealer with that and say, hey, thanks for the dupes.
Exactly.
Not thinking very clearly.
Yeah, that kind of brings me into my next point. Like you said, I think actually that social aspect of Venmo is what draws a lot of millennials in. It's kind of like its own little news feed where you can see people, doing whatever they're doing. But yeah, we did a poll. We want to find out, we actually ran a poll last year where we tracked about 500,000 Venmo transactions, and we found out, the majority of transactions were fantasy football, beer, and pizza, or any order of those three. So following up on that study, we want to say, hey, I wonder how many millennials are using Venmo to pay for drugs and, pay for gambling or whatever taboo activity you can think of. And we actually found, I'm going to pull up the exact number now. I think it was about, 30%, maybe even a little bit more of people that were using Venmo have used Venmo to pay for drugs / gambling. I'm trying to find the exact number. But
that's the only ones that were stupid enough to somehow say what they did.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know about the rest of the people who say, hey, thanks for the hot dog, which was really a bag of Quaaludes or something.
Yeah, I mean, they can think they're being sneaky. I mean, like, some people will post like a leaf, but yeah, we all know that it was for a little bit of marijuana, so you're not really fooling anybody. So I got the exact numbers. It was 1/3 have used Venmo to pay for drugs, and 21% have used it to pay for gambling purposes or sports betting or whatever.
So what's interesting is another thing on here. Excuse me. The other thing is, there's something that you should probably track also. And maybe think about, and something that I have actually seen several times, is it Venmo being used as, we'll call it, an underground loan sharking on a P2P basis?
That's something our editorial team and our research team has never even thought about, polling for that idea. But that certainly is a very interesting idea to see if it is being, used as a loan sharking.
I would bet there's a lot of people.
Facilitator.
I'm telling you that there's a lot of things. I've seen it. And it's, these young people, they get some money and they're like, listen, I need maybe because of gambling, maybe because of drugs, can you lend me money? And they got rich friends that have Venmo balances. They say, sure, Here's $100. You're going to pay me $125 back at the end of the week. And I don't know if they keep ledgers or what they do, but they do it that way to keep it all out of the spotlight.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea.
That's what you get. These are the ideas you get coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I should be coming on here once a week, I think. But yeah, that's an interesting idea. Going off that, I've heard of stories of people just randomly requesting money on Venmo to complete strangers, saying, you know, requesting like $1 or $2 or 50 cents and just sending that out to about 100 people, some of them whom they don't even know on Venmo, and seeing if anyone, you know, donates them. So it kind of almost works like a GoFundMe or something like that.
And that's that whole GoFundMe stuff is, I mean, there are some viable things, we can get into that, but I mean, there are a lot of sucker deals out there. I mean, I've seen so many sucker deals, and I've always wondered, you know, hey, this guy got hurt in an accident. Can you please, I need $50,000. I'm thinking, wait a minute, does he have insurance? And why doesn't he have insurance? And if he doesn't have insurance, or you know, what's the reason why I'm doing this? But people seem to feel compelled to, I'll give $5. I'll give $10. Yeah. I don't know. It's just an easy way to set up a sob story on whether it's Facebook or GoFundMe and all that. Let's talk about credit card use, though. Let's kind of segue into this whole idea of we're dealing with peer-to-peer payment platforms. You know, for a while there, millennials and young people after the, we'll call it the meltdown of the financial crisis, were like, I am not touching credit cards. I'm not going to get a loan or a mortgage on a house. I'm not going to borrow to get a car or to, you know, buy something. I'm going to pay with cash. You know, that was a big thing. Pay with cash. And that's what some of these peer-to-peer things came out of, aside from the technology of them. But what are the thoughts on credit cards with millennials?
We just published the results. We did a poll, you know, asking millennials various questions about their credit card usage. That poll came out about 2 weeks ago, and we found some really interesting findings. One of the more interesting things that people seem to be drawn to was that 41%, so nearly half of millennials, right, are consider the thought of using a credit card a scary thing. And I think exactly to your point, that just plays into the whole growing up through the financial crisis of 07, 08. And, you know, just kind of the way debt was stigmatized as something that's going to ruin your finances and put you into, you know, debt that you can't climb out of. So I think, you know, millennials growing up in that era, being, you know, old enough where they could process economics, but not old enough where they were actually affected by a financial crisis, it impacted their use of credit cards now. So I think that's kind of an interesting theory that could definitely use some more research, but, you know, it seems pretty legitimate.
But let me ask you a question. Let me, Mike, on one hand, I think there's a healthy amount of fear that should be put in place when using credit cards or loans or anything else. There's the absolute fear, right? There's this from, I'm not doing it. I mean, I just met somebody the other day that she doesn't have a credit card. She has an emergency credit card, but she doesn't use any credit cards. To the opposite side of that, which is just spend more than you make and rack up the credit card bills. We've seen this 100 times to a point where you have, you know, this ridiculous 20%, 25% amount of money that you're paying the VIG, if you will, which I still don't understand how it's not illegal to charge 25% on credit cards, but okay. You know, just somewhere in the middle where, hey, you know what? I can use credit cards to make it a lot easier on myself to pay for things, to track what I'm spending, I don't really care about the 1 month lag in what I'm spending, because if you pay it off, it's not a big deal. It's just a rolling issue. And more importantly, for a safety factor, because if I pay somebody in cash for something, or even a check for that matter, sometimes trying to get your money back for a defective product or something that didn't arrive is a problem. Whereas a credit card could solve a lot of those things. And you also have, if somebody steals my wallet that has 10 grand in it, well, I'm SOL, right? But if I have credit cards and they have, you know, $10,000 worth of a credit line, I can just cancel the credit cards. So there are some benefits, not to mention the frequent flyer miles, the cash back and all that. But, but is there more of an acceptance coming now compared to where it was with millennials and credit cards, or are they slowly shifting over?
Shifting over to, you know, to credit being in more favor of credit cards?
Yeah, being more in favor of credit cards than cash.
Well, I've actually seen restaurants that no longer accept cash, which to me is absolutely fascinating that, you know, usually it's the other way around where some people don't accept credit cards, but they only accept cash. But now it's kind of been flipped where no one really accepts cash, only credit cards, which to me is pretty fascinating. So I think generally people are starting to move back towards credit cards from, you know, people that were scared off by the recession. So it seems like
they're growing up. Yeah, the point is they're growing up.
Yeah, I guess. Well said.
You know, that's what's happening. They're growing up and they're getting into the fray here. And the other thing is, we also know that, you know, who's benefiting from a lot of this? The credit card companies that are looking to go to a cashless society. There is a whole move to get onto a cashless society to a point that some governments are actually talking about, you know, what would life be like? Because, you know, there's a whole underground, like Venmo. You buy something from somebody, you pay them with Venmo, there's no tax. It's just a clear cash transaction. You know, you pay somebody with cash, well, it could be under the table and they don't report that. Whereas if you have credit cards, you know, there's a lot more of a paper trail, if you will. And I'm not sure what the technical word for that is besides paper trail. I guess it covers all of that. But there's a bit trail, if you will, of all of the different transactions, and that could be tracked and the government can collect their taxes because the black market, the gray market, whether it's illicit or legal items that they're buying are not able to be really to be done as much anymore. I mean, you can't go to your corner drug dealer and say, hey, I'll take, $50 that, $20. What's, okay, that's $120. All right, would you take Visa or MasterCard?
Yeah, do you guys take Visa?
You know, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. Yeah.
So
I think the only thing about that is, you know, a lot for low-income members of society that wouldn't be able to take out a credit card and just don't have the means to take out a credit card and are kind of just scraping by with, you know, cash, paycheck to paycheck, or, you know, not really paycheck, but wad of cash to wad of cash in their hand. You know, if they're doing construction or something like that, how are they going to get by? You know, if it's a cashless society, how are they going to pay for things if they don't have the means to take out a credit card? So, I mean, it's an interesting topic.
It's going to be fascinating. I think there's a lot of concern about, you know, people still, well, the older generation. I can speak somewhat to the almost older generation is that, you know, we like cash. I like cash. It makes me feel good. Nothing better than having a couple of hundreds in your pocket, like, you know, that until you break them, of course. Let's segue to student loans. Jeremy Corbyn is has been talking about forgiving student loan debt in the UK. And there's a lot of things that are going on because under the last, let's call it decade, there's been a push to higher education to a point that if you don't get a higher education, you're never going to work for the rest of your life and you're going to be a piece of crap. You can't even get a job as a sewer cleaner. You know, this has been the what's been presented, right?
Right.
And so everybody has to get a higher education. They're pushed into student loans and now they're coming out of college. And one of the things that we're seeing is that people are strapped with so much loans. And you know, what's going on here? Where is this going to end?
Yeah, I mean, bring up some interesting points. It's kind of, you have to weigh your pros and your cons. It's, so I want to go to college, get my degree, and all that comes with a degree, but I have to take on all this debt, or should I just skip through college, you know, miss out on the college experience and getting a bachelor's degree, associate's degree, master's degree, what have you. And so it's kind of, you know, you got to weigh your pros and cons. But, I mean, I've been covering the student loan debt situation in the UK for a couple months now. And it seems like a giant mess. If we think, you know, the student loan problem in the United States is bad, which it is, there's way more student loan debt in the U.S. than there is in the U.K. Their situation is in complete disarray. I mean, I'm writing a news article probably once, twice a week, and it's always something bad. I mean, so, yeah, recently Jeremy Corbyn had suggested, he's the leader of the Labour Party, he suggested, you know, just canceling all historic student loan debt, forgiving all student loans. And I think someone in his own party even said that would probably cost upward of £100 million. And
billion,
we need to, you know,
billion pounds, not million.
I believe it was 100 billion. Let me see right here.
Can't be 100 million. That's chicken change. That's
yeah,
that's
well, in the UK,
walking around money.
$100 billion, yeah, correct. Right. So it was $100 billion. A woman in his own party said, yeah, we're going to wait to make that policy until we get some accurate projections. And it turns out it would cost over $100 billion. So they kind of forced him to walk back on those statements. And, you know, he said, I did not make a commitment. We would write off all this student debt because at that stage I couldn't come up with an accurate projection. So he had to walk back on those comments. A lot of people in British politics kind of accuse him of just saying that Yeah, we're going to forgive everyone's student loan debt, you know, as a way to rack up votes amongst the younger voters.
We're going to get rid of all your loan debt slash vote for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's definitely a case to be made there, because I do think the Labor Party performed very well in the most recent elections. They won a couple of districts, or I forget what the term is there. They won a couple of areas that they haven't won in like 100 years or something. Yep. So, you know, it probably worked. So
say whatever you want. I think what they call them there in the UK is blowhards. You know, that's what that whole thing was. But what about the state of the private student loans? I've been seeing news articles and commentary about private student loans, which is not government backed, or at least government crammed down your throat. What's going on there?
Right. All right. So we did a report where we tracked over 80,000 applications through the LendEdu site of people looking to refinance their student loans. And so we have all this data, and we were able to find some pretty interesting findings. One is that the interest rate on private student loans increased by about an average of 0.67%. So not quite 1%, but, you know, it's still a pretty significant increase.
In what time period?
From 2015 and 2016 to 2016-2017. So just 1 year.
Okay.
It increased about 0.67%, mm-hmm. which, you know, so private student loans have gotten more expensive. It kind of falls in line with other trends. I know the Federal Reserve recently raised interest rates on federal student loans for undergraduates as well. So usually when that happens, the private market's going to follow suit and raise their interest rates just to stay competitive. That's actually is what happens. We had a ton of interesting findings from that study, though. It was so the average interest rate of a private student loan we found to be 7.99%.
Wow.
But we found, so, I mean, it's pretty high. We found that having a co-signer on your private student loan, which is usually a parent or a guardian or a family friend, is greatly, greatly beneficial to not only getting approved, but getting the best possible deal for your private student loan. So, for example, the average interest rate of a private student loan with a co-signer was 7.76%. The same interest rate for a private student loan without a co-signer was 9.25%.
Yeah.
So not quite 2 full percentage points, but almost. So you just see how much the lenders value having a co-signer on your student loan. Trying to find a couple other things.
That's all according to risk. I mean, obviously, if you have somebody else co-signing, that they can be responsible and the risk factors go down. So that's the actuarial risk factoring of you know, who's going to pay. Because, you know, I don't know if the same rules apply, but, you know, when you have public student loans or governmental student loans there, and you have a co-signer, mm-hmm. you know, if the student defaults on the loan, it goes obviously as co-signer back to the parents. And not only that, this whole thing doesn't stay out of bankruptcy. In other words, if you have a bankruptcy, it doesn't matter. You still got to pay back your student loans. I mean, it's a very harsh circumstance, not to mention the fact that the student loans, the government student loans, they're pretty strict on their payments. They don't give you much of a grace period.
Yeah, I believe it's about 6 months or maybe a little bit less.
If you're a few months late, they get pretty pissy.
Yeah, we did an interesting study a couple months ago where we found that a lot of student loan borrowers with co-signers did not realize that if they make a late payment, their credit score will go down, but also their co-signer's credit score will go down.
The whole thing's
a mess. You know, a lot of people think of a co-signer as just kind of like a safety net on the student loans, but it's not at all. In reality, they're equal partners, and, you know, whatever the student does, it's going to affect the co-signer and vice versa.
Right.
So, you know, I would just suggest, you know, before signing on with the co-signer, just understand the risk, because, you know, it can be greatly helpful, but it also can be greatly damaging.
I want to kind of segue to something totally different that's outside the area of millennials, and something that has always fascinated me, and it's the area of the lottery. You've done a lot of research. Yeah. You've done a lot of research on this whole lottery thing, and you actually went out and spent some money, and decided to say, well, what are the now? Obviously, this is not an exact science, because you'd have to spend a lot of money to get the actual parameters. But you spent about $1,000. On scratch-off tickets at various price points, from, I guess, $1 to $30 per scratch-off?
Correct.
And tell me about the results and why you did this.
So this was like a really fun study. We had $1,000 in cash during lunchtime. walked out to the nearest convenience store, plopped down $1,000, and the guy kind of looked at us like we had 10 heads. And we bought, I don't even know the exact amount of tickets. It was probably like 5 pounds worth of tickets. But mm-hmm. yeah, we bought increments of a couple $1 tickets, $5 tickets, $10 tickets. Just a really interesting outside-the-box idea we have, your odds of winning the lottery, and is it really worth it? And, can you come away with that big score that I think everyone dreams about when they play the lottery?
Mm-hmm.
So we bought $1,000 worth of tickets, brought them back into the office, and we were like madmen for about 20 minutes. We were scratching all of them off. They had all that, like, the dust that comes off the lottery tickets.
I hate
tickets.
That stuff. It gets all your fingernails.
Scattered. Yeah. My fingers were black for about 2 days from just like the residual dust. We only ended up losing about, spent $1,000 and we only lost, I think, let me pull it up right here. We only lost about $20 or so. So we actually didn't do that bad. Yeah. So we spent $1,000. We won back $974. So our return on investment was -2.6%, which wasn't as bad as we thought, but we got really, really lucky. We had one $20 ticket that returned like $550. So without that ticket, we would have been screwed.
Yeah, you'd be 50% loss on that, and that would have been crazy. So that's interesting. Now, around the country, have some stats on the lotteries and the amount that was paid out. I mean, first of all, let's state a couple of things that it is obviously a long shot to win the big lottos, the lotteries, but the other thing, but people play it anyway, I guess, hoping one day. I just actually met a guy in town who won the lottery in 2010. Nicest guy in the world.
Really?
Actually. Yeah. I spent some time with him recently. Really, really nice guy and just a fascinating story about this and what he's done and all, but that's the rarity. I mean, he won a nice chunk too. That's the rarity. So generally speaking, where is the most, lottery tickets? Where's the highest spending on lottery tickets around the country?
Right. So we found that actually wasn't even close either. Massachusetts spends the most on lottery tickets per capita. So how much the average resident of Massachusetts spends per year on lottery tickets, their expenditure per capita was $734.85. The next closest was actually another northeastern state. It was Rhode Island, and they were at $513.75. So, the difference between one and two was more than $200, which is,
now, why is that? Is that they have bigger lotteries that draw people in? Is there any particular reason that you found why this is the case?
In terms of, attitudes of people, I couldn't speak to that. But we did find that, Massachusetts had one of the biggest lotteries. The biggest lotteries were New York, California, Florida. And then Massachusetts fell in right after Florida. So, four of the more populated states in the United States have the biggest lotteries, which makes sense in terms of, people spending more per capita. I really can't speak to that. I guess people in Massachusetts must feel really lucky. I do know there's a lot of Irish people over there. So
they're probably going after the big ones, but here's what's interesting. The states that spent the least is kind of also, well, if we're looking at Northeast spends the most, but it's interesting to find the areas that spend the least. They're also congregated in the same basic area.
Right. It was North Dakota spent $34.09 per capita. So good for those people spending their money in wiser places, but they're probably never going to win the big one. So depends what side of the aisle you fall on.
Right.
But yeah, North Dakota, and then Montana spent the third least amount. They were at $53 per capita, and Nebraska was right there, and Oklahoma and Kansas were at towards the bottom. New Mexico was towards the bottom. So more rural western states turned out to spend less. Once again, they have less people, so their lotteries aren't as big. So, as compared to California or New York or Massachusetts. So I think it really has to do with the size and the population density of each state.
Yeah, I hear you. Fascinating information. I mean, all the way from millennials, all the way to lottery, how to spend money, how not to spend money, how to save money. LendEDU.com is the site where, I mean, what's really cool about your site, by the way, I like your graphs, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I like all the graphs. And I know for somebody that digs doing graphs that tell a story, clearly, mm-hmm. versus some of the crap you see out there, that, you know, putting together a good graphic is always, I think, that relates to a story, not as a filler, okay? Just something that actually is a part of it is really important. And the clarity and information that you glean from that actual chart or graph, I think is really important. So I see that you guys think the same thing.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I wish some people in my office had the same level of appreciation that you do.
get them on the show. I'll whip them into shape. But anyway,
I think I will.
LendEDU.com, and we'll put all the information on how to get in touch with Mike and find out more information about the things that they're talking about, because it's just a swath of information and education and studies and research that they've done on LendEDU.com. So, hey, Mike, thanks so much for joining me and taking part in this, and I appreciate all the hard work you do.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks a lot for having me on, Andrew. Had a great time.
All right, great. Thanks. Bye. That was interesting. I mean, we're always looking to find out more about what is not only involved in the various generations, but of course, what could be market moving. And if you think about the discussion that we had there just now, and you consider the fact that there is a move towards less cash by people, and the millennials and the various generations that are younger are starting to think about moving to that. You gotta realize that maybe the PayPals, the MasterCards, the Visas, you know, they have done very well, and they may continue to do so. And you look at just the stock, the Visa stock, which is, I mean, we're talking about a significant amount of growth over the last year. I think Visa itself is, close to somewhere around 400 to 500 points, maybe 400 points of the S&P, of the Dow Jones Industrial Average's rise over the year 2017 so far. So that's something. And obviously there's a lot of money to be made in that area. So keep your eye on this and in the area of credit, of course, and particularly looking at the opportunities in the area of a credit use from an investment standpoint. I think that's something to consider, right now. I wanted to just take a couple of minutes and talk about what to do when you're on the wrong side. When you're on the wrong side of the trade, when you made a bad decision, or at least your decision that you made turns out to be bad, maybe not so much of a bad decision, but what the outcome was. So many of you that listen to DH Unplugged know that we had a short position on for stamps.com. Now, one of the things we looked at was that while the stock was holding recently on its support level at a top end and it's been climbing very well, we looked at some of the valuations of it. We looked at some of the stock trends. We looked at what's happened oftentimes during a certain seasonality of the company's earnings season. We saw in particular what happened with Pitney Bowes. Pitney Bowes got absolutely obliterated on their earnings last week. And we said, this is an interesting place to think about adding a short position of stamps.com. Now, one of the things that you have to realize, and we did know ahead of time, was that stamps.com doesn't have a massive amount of volume. It had a good amount of short interest on the stock. So when you look at short interest, a lot of people think that, wow, it has such a great short interest. Maybe it's a terrible stock. Well, what happened sometimes, and in the case of stamps.com, they came out with their earnings, and their earnings beat pretty handily, I must say. And they actually guided higher for the year. And what happened? Well, the stock was up about 50 points to about over $200 per share after the print throughout the day. Now, we're short that position. That means that we're losing money. That means that that trade didn't work out, and what do? So after we analyzed the information and found out some information about what's going on, about their guidance with their conference call, and read through the various earnings release, et cetera, we decided this is an area and a position we're going to cut. When do you do it? Well, oftentimes you don't want to do it right on the knee-jerk reaction of when the earnings came out, because there'll be a short squeeze potentially. And in this particular circumstance, the stock had a pretty high, as I mentioned, short interest Therefore, there's going to be a lot of people running for cover once this thing comes out, and particularly if they beat. So the stock rallied a bit. We ended up selling it or actually covering the position for a loss. But we waited until the opening of the markets just to see how things played out, because oftentimes in the after hours where there's limited liquidity, and especially on a stock that doesn't trade a lot to begin with in the after hours, that there was the opportunity to see if there's going to be a pullback. Now, in this case, there really wasn't a pullback. We're priced in the pre-markets is pretty much where it's set up in the right when the bell went off at 9:30 in the morning last week on Thursday. So what we did is we cut the position because, you know what, it was starting to run away from us, and we took into consideration all the different components of what we saw on a fundamental basis on the earnings, and we said that right now we're going to step aside. Now, will we re-enter this? Possibly. We'd have to see a dynamic change. What was the reason that it went up and why we saw its competitor and one of the competitors in the market, for example, Pitney Bowes, do so poorly? Well, obviously, it wasn't a sector issue. Rather, Stamps.com was getting business and gaining business from their competitors. So that was something that we realized that, you know what, we made a mistake, that it wasn't just simply a sector-wide type of situation or a similar situation with a company that was in a, you know, in the postage business, that there was something else going on here. Now, one of the things looking back on this, because you always want to look back, okay, where did I make the mistake? Looking back on this, I saw that there was the incorrect notion that, the short interest wouldn't be that difficult, and there wouldn't be, of course, the comparison. But really, we should have been a little bit more sensitive to the fact that we are in a bullish market environment, number one. Number two, it was enough short interest that would cause a squeeze. Okay, that's important. And the volumes haven't been that significant lately. Therefore, that there would be a major move into it if, in fact, they beat. The final point was that even though we were in the money on this for a little while, the fact was that this stock kept on popping up. And into earnings, while we saw some of that maybe was because of positions unwinding into the earnings print, the reality was the stock would not really get rolled over even when the markets were a little bit weak. There was a couple of days there that was down a couple of percent to 4% another day. But generally speaking, there was obviously something behind the scenes that we didn't know about that we maybe should have picked up on a little bit better. So always try to analyze your trades. Look for all the different components. Make sure that you understand what you're getting into. And we thought we had a pretty good idea, but this did run away from us in a pretty significant way. But that happens. You know, it's going to happen. You're not going to be right on every single trade all the time. So just consider that from what you're doing when you're especially going short in a bullish market environment. Keep your trade positions light and lower than you would normally. Add on to them if they start working in your way. Be careful of earnings when they're coming out, especially in a condition where when you see that companies don't do well and don't meet their earnings, that the stocks don't have much of a reaction on the way down. Now, there's been a bunch of stocks, of course, that have seen an implosion when they miss terribly. But when you look at the markets right now, there's a lot of just saying, well, maybe they'll do better next quarter. We're not going to penalize them for one quarter of losses. And the stocks hold up pretty well. And we see even if they don't hold up well, the next day buyers are at it again, trying to nudge them higher, thinking that, well, there's money available, liquidity is great, let's keep on buying, how bad can it be? Anyway, just consider that. We're going to wrap it up here, and I hope you enjoyed the show. And again, ask Andrew over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can go there and check it out. Ask me any questions, give me comments, feedback, ideas for guests, and follow me on Twitter. Of course, listen to DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesdays and on your podcast finders because John C. Dvorak, myself, we have quite the time each Tuesday talking about all sorts of crazy things. Plus, there's a chat room where listeners can actually chat and participate in the show as we're talking and streaming live at 9 o'clock on Tuesdays. DHUnplugged.com. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you again next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.